This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
These did not say exactly how much money their proposal would save, but it appears to be far less than the $600 million from HB 3194. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Shannon White of the Partnership for Safety and Justice.
What does HB 3194 consist of?
Well, 19 recommendations, so it's quite a lot. It does have some of the proposals that the DAs listed out in theirs, because those were part of their recommendations for the process, including changes to laws for possession of marijuana, to driving while suspended. Then additionally some larger changes than what the DA said to Measure 57 and also to Measure 11. I think it's important to note, I mean, there are other recommendations on ways to save money that also are good policy for Oregon. And what's important to remember about it is that it's part of a larger process, not just to avert prison growth, which was part of it, but it's because prison growth is so expensive, and that we need to invest in other parts of our public safety system. I'm sure as you and many of your listeners have heard, places like Josephine County, corrections have been decimated over the last decade, and there are very serious local law enforcement, community corrections, and in fact, victim services needs that aren't currently being met at nearly the level they're needed around the state. So this is about creating good policy, finding savings through that good policy by making our public safety system more efficient and more effective, and then reinvesting it into important parts of our public safety system, again, victim services, community corrections, local law enforcement.
Now, some of the opponents of HB 3194 say it would end up putting sex offenders back on the street. What is your group's thought on that?
I think that's a real mischaracterization of one proposal in the bill, which is a modification to Sex Abuse 1, which would just allow there to be more judicial discretion in sentencing. So that doesn't mean a judge would just be making the sentencing decision rather than the district attorney within our sentencing guidelines. So I think that's a mischaracterization, and there are there were very legitimate reasons for that recommendation, and others were on sentencing reforms, where sometimes some of these crimes, the offense can be very, very serious and certainly warrant maybe a lengthy prison sentence, but sometimes the same charge can be a much less serious offense. And so they're trying to take into account, we need judges to be making that decision so that people aren't being subject to mandatory minimum sentences, even within a wide variety of crimes that may have been committed.
The bill, HB 3194, in the Oregon State Legislature is currently in the Ways and Means Committee, as I understand, and I wonder if you have any idea of a timeline for when it might go to the legislature for a vote.
I think 3194 right now is actually in a committee that was specially formed to consider the bill, which is the Joint Committee on Public Safety. It's a House and Senate bipartisan committee, obviously, that had a number of hearings and public testimony on the bill at the beginning of session, and we are hoping that by next week, hopefully, because we are getting close to the end of session here, that we'll start to see what's in a final package.
If people are interested in finding out more or getting involved in the Partnership for Safety and Justice, where would they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Online, we are at safetyandjustice.org. And our phone number is 503-335-8449, and we'd love to have people get involved.
Thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Shannon White of the Partnership for Safety and Justice here in Oregon. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Overcrowding is rampant across America's prisons, but one Multnomah County detention center is contending with a different kind of space issue. The Wapato Jail in North Portland has 170,000 square feet of empty space. It's been a decade since it was built in the Rivergate Industrial Area, and at the time, the $58 million facility was lauded as state-of-the-art, complete with glass tiles and vaulted ceilings, but a decade later, the jail remains empty and unused as the county lacks the funding to operate the facility. In 1996, voters approved a bond to build the 525-bed facility. Then, they also approved several tax-limiting measures that made it impossible for the county to secure the money needed to operate it. In the years since Wapato's construction, crime rates have dropped in Oregon. Sentencing rules have also become more lenient, leading to a decrease in the number of offenders entering the criminal justice system. However, overcrowding remains an issue in other prisons and jails across Oregon. Even standing empty, the facility costs between $300,000 and $400,000 a year to maintain. Over a 10-year period, the taxpayer tab for this unused jail has reached $3.5 million. Hollywood film producers have rented the prison for film shoots, but other possible uses for the building have lacked the funding necessary to make them happen.
A Beaverton police officer was arrested on Wednesday at his Vancouver home and formally charged with the rape of a child. Christopher R. Warren joined the Beaverton Police Department in 2004 and was placed on paid leave in 2009 while the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office investigated a claim that he inappropriately touched a girl when he was 17. That case was dropped in April 2010, but a month later, Warren was placed on leave again for failure to report suspected child abuse by one of his childhood friends. Warren was fired in 2011 and reinstated to a desk job 9 months later, and then arrested this past April for, among other things, food stamp fraud. This was all prior to the accusations of child rape, which began in early May when a Vancouver woman became alarmed when a 5-year-old girl began talking about bathing rituals and raised other red flags indicating possible sexual abuse. Warren is being held in Clark County Jail based on the rape charges and will appear in court on Tuesday to face his food stamp-related charges. In a related story, a civilian worker at the Marion County Jail was arraigned today on charges of first-degree official misconduct based on allegations that he had sexual inappropriate reactions with female inmates in the past year. Marion County's Sheriff's Office spokesman Don Thompson did not specify the misconduct of which facility security aide Nathaniel Johnson is accused, but did say it was unlikely there was any physical contact. Security aides at the prison can control cell doors and can communicate with inmates via intercom.
The Hillsborough Police Department found itself in a sticky situation this week. The sergeant, who decided to battle crime with jugs of maple syrup, has been reassigned to patrol duty, while the officer who blew the whistle on his unorthodox methods sits in jail. Hillsborough Police Sergeant Bruce Kelly has admitted to smearing TriMet benches with maple syrup to deter loitering. At the same time, former police officer Tim Cannon alleges that he faced retaliation for calling attention to the sergeant's use of maple syrup. In an official complaint filed last year, Cannon alleged that Kelly poured maple syrup on several benches at the Willow Creek platform in Hillsborough, a busy MAC stop where police claim that loitering and drinking occur regularly. Records show that Kelly, who was assigned to transit police at the time, purchased 2-gallon jugs of maple syrup from an Albertson store and expensed those and their $20 cost to the city. Kelly admitted to pouring maple syrup from the jugs onto a bench. Cannon is now at the center of his own controversy. Soon after he filed the complaint, the department opened an investigation into Cannon, who allegedly had issues with alcohol and absenteeism. Cannon was involved in a shootout with fellow officers at his home last January after his dismissal from the force, and he remains in jail awaiting trial.
Clackamas County has decided not to renew their contract with Whole Systems Counseling and Consultation, an embattled Southeast Portland psychiatric clinic that treats registered sex offenders. The county contracted with Whole Systems to provide court-mandated treatment, as does Multnomah County. The Clackamas contract expires on June 30th, and their Community Corrections Department has announced it does not plan to renew it. The department field services manager, Jenna Morrison, said the decision was not based on community protests against the clinic's location, but simply boiled down to the county opting to work with another provider. Whole Systems was kicked out of the Selwood neighborhood at the beginning of the year when residents protested its location near a Montessori school in a family-oriented neighborhood. The clinic now faces community opposition at its new location in the Mill Park neighborhood, at the intersection of Southeast Stark Street and 126th Avenue. It is unclear whether the loss of the Clackamas County contract will encourage the clinic to move again.
Today, Oregon lawmakers are debating some of the final pillars of Governor John Kitzhaber's sweeping education reforms. House Bill 3120 would consolidate the oversight of Oregon's entire higher education system into one board, the Higher Education Coordination Commission, known as the HECC. Instead of the legislature deciding how much money goes to four-year universities, to community colleges, and financial aid, under the House bill, the legislature would only grant a lump sum to the HECC, which would then divvy it up as it saw fit. Meanwhile, Senate Bill 270 would allow the University of Oregon and Portland State University to create their own governing boards. These boards would be independent in most matters except budget development, program approval, and mission approval, which the HECC will oversee and coordinate with the broader state higher education system. Together, these bills exemplify the two prongs of Kitzhaber's reforms: local governance of schools and a consolidated state apparatus for funding and coordinating them.
The Portland Arts Tax deadline has been moved to June 10th. The tax, which will go to support art programs in the schools and other programs around town, has been postponed twice already. Its original deadline was set to be April 15th, but because of confusion about income requirements, it was pushed off until May 15th. Payment can be made either by mail or online, but so many people paid online last week that the City of Portland's computer system crashed. Because of this, the deadline was once again extended. The $35 arts tax applies to all people living in Portland making over $1,000 a year, but Social Security income does not count towards that income requirement.
Little brown bins overflowing with eggshells and onion skins are a common sight in kitchens across Portland, where composting has become something of an unofficial pastime. Come summer, those efforts will translate into a little extra change in the pockets of conservation-minded Portlanders. The Portland City Council approved yesterday a 1% rate decrease. A 1% rate decrease for Portland's residential garbage and recycling customers effective July 1st. Portland's revamped waste collection program will dole out brown bins for food scraps and green bins for yard waste, in addition to traditional recycling and garbage bins, with regular garbage being picked up every other week. Since taking effect a year and a half ago, the program has led to a 37% reduction in landfill-bound garbage, according to the city's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. Portlanders have composted almost 120,000 tons of yard debris and food scraps, including 13,000 tons of food waste that would have ended up at the dump. Because composting is cheaper than landfill disposal, the trend also means a drop in fees for Portland residents, even as waste disposal companies invest in costlier and more environmentally friendly collection trucks. The numbers are a sure sign that the city's program is thriving, said Portland Mayor Charlie Hale. One bonus product is an abundance of nutrient-rich compost now being used to grow food in community garden beds across the city.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa, KABU's Native American News and Culture program, at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, talk radio from a hip-hop perspective, hosted by Davey D. The weather today is rainy and cold. Nearly 2 inches of rain have fallen in the last 48 hours and have been accompanied by record low temperatures of 50 degrees on Wednesday. This made yesterday the coldest May 22nd since 1940, when weather records began to be kept. Tomorrow's weather will most likely be rainy, with a high near 60 degrees. The evening will be mostly cloudy with a chance of continued showers and a low around 49 degrees, but the weather is expected to get a bit more dry and warm by the end of the holiday weekend.
It's 19 minutes after 5 o'clock. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Imagine net zero. That's the wonky phrase attached to an elegant idea. Namely, converting communities to total renewable energy, complete recycling, and a culture of conservation to bring humankind's carbon footprint into a sustainable balance with a healthy Earth. Now, imagine the least likely place you'd expect this ideal to take root and even flourish. How about an army base? In Texas, no less. Astonishingly, America's net zero future is being pioneered at Fort Bliss, a sprawling military base of 35,000 soldiers in El Paso. The post already has a 1.4 megawatt solar array and has placed rooftop solar panels on all base housing, generating 13.4 megawatts of energy. And it's in partnership with El Paso Electric to add a 200-acre 20 megawatt solar farm by 2015. It also has a plan to convert post waste into energy, is engaged in wind power, geothermal, and conservation projects, is promoting energy-efficient vehicles, and is building bicycle lanes. The Army. Who knew they cared? Bliss's rank-and-file soldiers, as well as the brass, are committed to achieving the goal of net zero by 2018, meaning the base will generate all the energy it uses and do it with renewables. Adding to the effort, the troops have planted nearly 15,000 trees and have become converts to recycling. To encourage the latter, the base commander, General Dana Pittard, has put the $1 million a year revenue from recycling into skating parks, exercise facilities, and other morale-boosting recreation projects. It's fostering a conservation culture, hoping that the soldiers will take it with them when they go on. This is Jim Hightower saying there's hope for the Earth when even the Army begins to change.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
An effort to recall Sherwood City Councilor Matt Langer is underway for what some see as a conflict of interest. Many residents of Sherwood, already protesting the pending construction of a Walmart in their city, have targeted Langer because his family owns the property where it will be built. Jennifer Harris, president of the newly created Sherwood Community Action Committee, views Langer's financial stake in the matter a problem. Harris stated, quote, "His abilities to make decisions for the city of Sherwood is clouded by his love and desire for his family to thrive." Langer has said that although he does not have voting rights in the family company, he is a coordinator and liaison with Gramer Development, the other owner and developer of the property. Langer has recused himself on votes concerning his own financial interests, but Harris thinks that this is not enough. Harris said, quote, "He can recuse himself, but his circle of influence goes outside of himself and onto other city councilors and planning commissioners. The Sherwood citizens who have been attending city council and planning commission meetings must collect 700 signatures by August 15th for the recall petition. An election would take place within 40 days after signature verification under Oregon law.
Foreclosed on homeowners from the Portland metropolitan area wrapped up their visit to the nation's capital by calling on their representatives in the U.S. Senate. As yet, there's no public response from either Senator Jeff Merkley or Senator Ron Wyden regarding the visits from their constituents about the foreclosure crisis. Both Debbie Austin and Mae Wallace were arrested earlier this week for participating in a demonstration at the Department of Justice. More than 30 activists got arrested by the Department of Homeland Security in conjunction with the three-day-long demonstration. According to Carrie Coe of We Are Oregon, some were tasered and/or placed in solitary confinement, and she describes many arrests as being unnecessarily brutal. She explained the action's objective as being putting a halt to evictions at a national level. Coe said conferences to identify what the next steps for the campaign will be scheduled once all of the participants have recouped from events in District of Columbia.
U.S. Senator for Oregon Ron Wyden weighed in on the targeting of right-wing groups by the IRS during a hearing today. the Obama administration has come under fire since an internal review last week found that some IRS officers in Ohio scrutinized groups that had Tea Party or Patriot in their name. According to Wyden, groups that file for the new 501c4 status should expect to have extra scrutiny.
For me, the basic proposition is simple. Notwithstanding the troubling and unacceptable conduct of the IRS, if political organizations do not want to be scrutinized by the government, they shouldn't seek privileges like tax-free status and anonymity for their donors. To argue otherwise is to advantage tax cheats to the detriment of law-abiding Americans. That's why my hope is that out of this debate will come clear and enforceable rules that treat all political groups equally. So with respect to questions, Mr. Miller and Mr. Shulman, the lines have blurred between political active groups that disclose their donors, those are the 527s, and those who do not, those are the 501c4s. And it has become apparent that organizations that ought to be 527s are applying for C4 status to avoid disclosure obligations. That means there is an incentive for people to choose their tax status based on whether they want to hide their donors. My view is that's a loophole that Congress ought to close. Given that to be exempt from federal income tax, Section 501c4 of the code requires nonprofits to operate exclusively, as opposed to substantially or primarily, for the promotion of social welfare, my question to the two of you, Mr. Shulman and Mr. Miller, why was this problem not corrected? Mr. Shulman.
Senator, could you just clarify the problem?
Yeah, the lines blurred. The lines have blurred between the 527s and the 501c4s, so there's an incentive for people to choose their tax status based on whether they want to hide their donors. I think it's real straightforward. The lines blurred, and you all don't seem to have done anything about it, and I want to know why not.
Well, look, let me state that I think the law in the tax-exempt area is very complex, like the rest of our...
Mr. Shulman, we understand all that. Why didn't you do anything on your watch to correct it?
So let me continue. The Treasury regulations that the IRS staff in Cincinnati was wrestling with in this case are longstanding regulations. I believe they're 40 plus years
50.
Old. 50. And I did see that the Inspector General in his report recommended that Treasury ought to look at the regulations. I heard the chairman say he was going to look at this, and all I can say is that, this is a very hard task given to the IRS. To have the IRS, which needs to process 140 million tax returns and get billions of dollars refunds out to people every year, to also have them have this piece of the operation that by the law has to be asking questions about political activities is very difficult. And so from where I sit as a former IRS commissioner, if Congress could help clarify the law, that would be a very helpful thing.
Mr. Miller, same question. What did you do to correct this problem on your watch?
So we have put out some guidance, but not enough. I mean, the issues are several fold. One is we get 70,000 applications for exemption a year. The number of those that are C4s is much less, but even those have doubled over the last few years. There is no doubt that since 2010, when Citizens United sort of released this wave of cash, that some of that cash headed towards C4 organizations. That's proven out by FEC data and IRS data. That does put pressure on us to take a look. As I had mentioned earlier, 527 organizations can do all the politics they want to do. 501c4 organizations have a limited ability to do politics.
So
that's a legal issue.
What troubles me is on your watch, when the lines are blurring on this disclosure issue, as far as I can tell, you all didn't do anything to correct the problem in a meaningful way. And I think that's very regrettable.
That was U.S. Senator from Oregon Ron Wyden questioning outgoing IRS Commissioner Stephen Miller. Miller resigned after a media-created scandal last week challenged the IRS for investigating whether newly created political nonprofit organizations engaged in political activity.
The Boy Scouts of America voted today to allow gay youth to be part of their program, which had historically restricted its membership by sexuality. Last summer, the Boy Scouts voted to continue to keep boys that identified as gay out of their ranks, but the decision was overturned this afternoon with a 60% vote. More than 1,400 delegates from Boy Scout troops across the country voted on the issue. Although gay kids will be permitted to join the organization, adults will still be screened based on their sexuality. Many LGBTQ activists think that the inclusion is not going far enough, arguing that adults should also be able to participate regardless of their sexual orientation. The Boy Scouts has strong church affiliations, and many of its religious supporters believe that removing the anti-gay ban is already going too far. The new policy will come into effect on January 1st of next year, and gay boys will gain entrance to Boy Scout troops across the country. KBOO reporter Jen Chavez spoke with Greg Burke, a proponent of overturning the ban, following this announcement.
So what's your reaction to the vote that was just announced in regards to gay membership of the Boy Scouts?
My reaction is one of great joy. It's actually a tremendous achievement, I think. No one was absolutely positive what was going to happen with this vote. There was a great deal of just concern about whether there might be a vote past this. That's something that's been discussed with the Boy Scouts for the last several months, and they've been talking to everyone under the sun throughout their membership ranks, and I just wasn't sure what to expect. So I'm very, very happy now that gay youth will no longer be banned from membership in the Boy Scouts.
And what had influenced the Boy Scouts to take up this issue now?
I think it's been a combination of things. There have been some very high-profile cases lately where adults and youth have been removed from the Boy Scouts for simply because they're gay. Some Boy Scouts have been denied their Eagle rank right before getting their Eagle rank just because they came out. And a lot of corporations have started to withdraw funding from the Boy Scouts, and the United Way have started to withdraw financial support from the Boy Scouts. I think they were just starting to take a lot of heat from all sides, and they really felt like that this was time to do something to really try to stem some of their losses, financial losses, their membership losses, and some of the negative PR that they've been having to deal with over the last few years.
And from here, this vote affects members of the Boy Scouts, but does not affect the ban on gay scout leaders. What could be the pathway towards addressing that issue in the future?
Well, that's what we're going to be struggling with now that gay youth have been admitted. I think one of the things that's going to lead to future change will be when gay youth start aging out of the program and present themselves to be gay adult leaders. The scouting program is designed so that when boys age out at 18, they are encouraged to, and in fact expected to, remain active in the scouting program and become leaders. So it's supposed to be, theoretically, kind of a lifetime commitment. You start as a Cub Scout, you go all the way through the Boy Scout program, and then when you're done, you roll over and you become a scout leader. And that happens remarkably often. Now they've set up a special condition where people can enter as a six-year-old in the first grade, spend 10 years in scouting, and then 12 years in scouting, and then at that point, magically, they're no longer eligible for membership just because they're gay and they have to leave. That's the kind of thing that's nonsensical. It can't be defended, and there's just no way that it can stand for very long.
I've been speaking with Greg Burke, a former assistant scoutmaster and an affiliate of Change.org. He was responsible for starting several petitions working towards the overturn of the gay membership ban. For KBOO News, this has been Jen Chavez. Legal advocacy group, the Center for Constitutional Rights, or CCR, has filed a federal lawsuit in civilian court seeking more transparency and press access in the case of Army whistleblower Bradley Manning. Manning is currently facing a military tribunal for his connection to massive leaks of Afghan and Iraqi war documents, U.S. diplomatic cables, and classified videos to the transparency group WikiLeaks. Manning's year-long pretrial has been criticized for press restrictions that have made covering the case extremely difficult for reporters. Following an unauthorized audio leak to the press of Bradley Manning's own testimony in recent months, the judge presiding over the case, Denise Lind, responded by warning that the press room was a privilege that could be taken away. CCR had previously filed a similar suit in the Military Court of Appeals, but it was rejected after more than 6 months of deliberation. The current lawsuit was filed along with several prominent journalists, including Amy Goodman, Jeremy Scahill, and Glenn Greenwald. Today I spoke with Shaina Kadidal, one of the attorneys with CCR, for more information on the lawsuit.
In the federal complaint that was filed by CCR, partnering with several prominent journalists attempting to cover the Manning trial, if the federal lawsuit was granted in your favor, what would be made available to press that is not now available?
We're after basically, you know, the documents that you would ordinarily have available to the press and public in any criminal trial in the non-military courts. So, you know, trials are very difficult for journalists to cover. There's a lot going on, and, you know, they rely on the transcripts of the proceedings. Even if they're allowed to sit in court and hear everything, you know, usually sometimes within, you know, a minute of something being said, it pops up on a screen and they can check their notes and use it to help write their stories and so forth. In the same way, they're not releasing any of the, publishing any of the briefs by the defense or the prosecution. Finally, the judge's own rulings haven't been published, and it's kind of crazy what she does, actually. She'll read them out loud in open court where anybody who shows up can come in there. So there's nothing secret or classified about these opinions, but she won't publish them in document form. So these are, you know, it seems sort of absurd, but, you know, I suppose maybe a certain amount of absurdity is par for the course in military justice.
What are the grounds on which the judge is limiting access to these documents?
Well, basically what she said was that the First Amendment, which in civilian courts, it's very clear, guarantees a right of access to the courtroom and to the